Okay, I think we can get going now. But first of all, after last evening's talk, how many of you encountered a ghost? Anyone? Oh. It just shows you that sometimes we're afraid of things which never happen. We worry about things which don't occur. And we're anxious about the future when there's no need to be. And it's a very good exercise to show that all this worry and fear and concerns we have are just wasting a lot of inner energy. And even when you go home and little things happen, you find on these retreats you have these wonderful ways of dealing with the problems of life, which are innovative. They work. They're not based on chemicals, so they have no bad side effects. Indeed, the side effects you do get are wonderful. I don't know why, but no. I told Nicholas, who was just cleaning up my breakfast stuff this morning, I don't know why people like cleaning up the breakfast stuff. I think that sometimes whatever's left over, they eat, because they know it's been sanctified by the monk. So whatever they eat, if it's very sugary, they don't get diabetes. If it's very oily, they don't get cholesterol problems, because the monk has sorted that out beforehand. Sometimes they think, oh, these monks have got all these powers. And so much so that, you know, sometimes you wonder, if you leave anything, do they keep that as a relic, just in case? And this comes to my mind because my dentist, who won't be named, but he used to be a past president. I think you probably know who he is now. Many, many, many years ago, I went to see him, and I think one of my teeth was cracked, and you couldn't sort of put it together again. So he had to take it out, had to remove it. And later on, he actually came up to confess to me. He said, once he took the tooth out, instead of throwing it away like dentists are supposed to do, he kept it. So what do you want to keep the tooth for? Well, you know, in the future, if you become really, really holy, that might be worth a lot of money. So I'm really afraid of going to see him now. He might take another tooth out. Not it needs to be taken out, but it's just an investment for his future. No, he doesn't do that. He's a very good man. But sometimes the people's belief systems are a bit strange. So if there is a good monk, a good nun, you don't worship the monk or nun, the body. What we actually do, we respect the teachings, the Dhammas. So that is why that we don't really do this here, but it's really hard to explain. But sometimes in, say, Thailand, where I grew up, whenever a monk gave a talk, they put a big fan, this big fan in front of them when they were giving the talk. Just like those of you who came to our Katina Day, see, the monks when doing the chanting put a fan in front of themselves when they were doing some chanting. And the reason why they were supposed to do that when they were, you know, in the old tradition, was you can't see the face of the monk or the nun. You just hear the teachings, the Dhamma. And that's wonderful to be able to do that. So it takes away the personality away from the Dhamma. And that's far more effective. So that's also one of the reasons why I don't mind when I go past that whiteboard outside the kitchen and dining room and have all these quotes by Ajahn Funny Brahm or Ajahn Donut or Ajahn something else. It doesn't really matter about the name. What is really important is respecting the teachings. That's more important. And these days, it's always a little bit of a difficulty for me because I give so many teachings. In the old days, even Ajahn Chah, he could give the same teachings many times. But now, We've got internet, they're all recorded. So it's very, 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 very rare that I can say a story or emphasize some Dhamma and you haven't heard it before. So much so that some of the talks I've given, some of the famous talks which I've given, have this wonderful titles like Buddhism and Coffins. Have you heard that one? It's on the internet somewhere. Oh, Buddhism and Bananas. Do you like bananas? What was Buddhism and Bananas? And it started off with a little anecdote which somebody told me that when you eat a banana, do you have a banana this morning? Yeah, if you had a banana this morning, how do you open the banana? Usually on the stalk, you sort of break it off and then peel it, but that's always really hard. But if you go into the forests and see monkeys eat bananas, they don't break off the stalk to peel it. They break it off the other end where the flower was. And you'll find, next time you have a banana, try that. You find it's much easier to peel from that end, where the flower once was, than on the stalk end. And so it just actually shows you, human beings, we think we know so much, and we should respect, the people who got the most experience with bananas, monkeys. In the same way, I think I gave this an introduction to one of those books. In the same way, I said that when you learn meditation, people do meditation all sorts of different ways. But like the monkeys are the experts with bananas, the monks are the expert with Nibbana. So you can do it the way the monks and the nuns do it. Just learning how just to relax and take it easy. And also to have some fun and joy when you're meditating. And there's some things we learn as Sangha, which as sometimes people, especially lay meditation teachers, they say all sorts of interesting stuff, but it's not really quite accurate. A good example of that is on the subject of monks and monkeys and bananas, that we have something people call the monkey mind. Have you heard that one before? And people assume that's a mind which is just thinking too much. That is not the monkey mind. If you want to know what the monkey mind is, listen to this story. There was a monkey, and the monkeys are the experts on what is monkey mind, for good reason. And one day, the monkey, it was Waisak Day. This was in Sri Lanka, this happened. The monkey went to the big temple on Waisak Day, the celebration of the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, passing away. And when the monkey went there, he went there not to listen to Dhamma. He learned, because so many people there, so much food, someone's going to drop something. And so the monkey can get a mango or a banana or a papaya or something. So he went there waiting for someone to drop something. But while he was waiting for someone to drop something, he heard the priest giving the sermon, the Waisak sermon. And what really caught the monkey's attention was when the monk started talking about monkey mind. And the monkey thought, oh, they're talking about me. So he went to listen. And as he was listening, the monkey was horrified, was appalled, was just so upset and angry because the monk was saying a monkey mind is bad. It's evil. It's terrible. You shouldn't have a monkey mind. You should train yourself out of monkey minds. Monkey mind is bad. You'll never get enlightened with monkey mind. You never get even peace with monkey mind. You never get any happiness with the monkey mind. The monkey mind should be stopped. And the monk was really upset. Sorry, the monkey was really upset. He said, this is the 21st century. You cannot stigmatize anybody in our present world. Just because I'm a monkey doesn't mean my mind is bad. You're just stereotyping me. This is abuse. This is violence to my monkeyness. And he was really upset. So he immediately left, hadn't found any food yet, swung back into the jungle, swung back into the place where his tribe of monkeys lived, and started telling all the monks. You wouldn't believe what these priests, people respect these monks. They're supposed to have right speech. But you should hear what they're saying about us, that we've got monkey minds and they're terrible minds and it's really wrong. We should get a lawyer. We should go to the World Wildlife Foundation and make a complaint. Someone go to the UN. And all the other monkeys were jumping up and down, agreeing, yeah, they can't do this. Yeah, this is wrong. This is terrible. You shouldn't call us a monkey mind. Monkey minds are okay. We're monkeys. We're okay. And the head monkey, who was old, says, be quiet. All that jumping up and down, that's what the monkey mind is. And they all understood. Oh, my goodness, yeah. We've all got monkey minds. What can we do about it? And then the head monkey, you know, the old fellow, said, well, you know, I've been to that temple many times before, and I've heard those monks say about monkey mind. The best way to deal with the monkey mind is to meditate. So all the monkeys jumped up and down. Yeah, let's meditate. Yeah, we want to meditate. Yeah, let's meditate. Let's get out of the monkey mind. Yeah, we want to meditate. Yeah. The head monkey said, shut up. I'll teach you how to meditate. As much as I know, said the head monkey. Yeah, how do we meditate? Teach us, we want to meditate. What do we do? Come on, let us know now. Yeah, I want to meditate. It's supposed to be very good for you, meditation, so let's do it now. And when they shut up after another 15 minutes, he said, well, first of all, you've got to get a nice cushion to sit on, like the Zephyrs. Yeah, let's get a cushion. We'll get a cushion. Yeah, where do we get a cushion? What do we mean a cushion? We don't have cushions in the jungle. So the head... I think I had too strong a tea this morning. The head monk said, well, these little round things, nice and soft. So go into the forest, get some grass, some leaves and something, and make them all the nice little cushions. So all the monkeys, they're very good at doing things. They're not very good at just sitting still. So nevertheless, they went out, they got themselves a nice little cushion and made a nice thing. They went really round. Some were big, some were small, some were wide. And they put them on the ground. Now what do we do? You sit on them. Oh, yeah. Okay, so they sat on the cushions. Now what? And the head monkey said, well, I'm not really sure, but I've seen them. What the most monks do, they sit down on that cushion, put their right leg over their left leg, straight back, the right paw over the left paw, close their eyes and watch their breath. Yeah, let's do that. Yeah, it's a good idea. Yeah, we'll do this. So all sat down. And right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw, straight back, chin in, started watching their breath. And that was the first time ever in history, in Sri Lanka, it's a long history in Sri Lanka, the first time that jungle had ever been so quiet. The first time that monkeys ever meditated for about 30 seconds. And then one monkey opened their eyes, put their paw up and said, excuse me. During that meditation, I was thinking. And I was thinking, you know that we all agreed, it was agreed, that for lunch we'd go to the banana plantation, because all at the temple and doing their waste act, we'd go to the banana plantation and steal lots of bananas for lunch. I know it's not lunch yet, but, you know, we've got to do that. Let's get that out of the way first, and then we'll meditate. Yeah, good idea, said everybody. Yeah, wonderful idea. Brilliant. So they all got off their seats and swung to the banana plantation, stole a lot of bananas, but it wasn't lunch yet. They couldn't eat them yet. So they put them in the middle of the plantation, a big pile of plantations, like a stupa. I think that's where the idea of a stupa came from. I don't know. But anyway, a big pile of bananas in the center. And then he went back on their zafus, right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw, straight back. Close their eyes, chin in, watching the breath, breathing in, breathing out. Excuse me! Said another monkey. I've been thinking that before we eat those bananas, we're not going to eat them yet, it's not lunchtime. Before we eat them, we have to peel them first. I've been thinking about that, so let's peel them first of all, because once we're all peeled, that's out of my way, I don't have to think about it anymore. Yeah, I was thinking the same, said another monkey. Yeah, me too, let's do it. So they all got off their cushions, peeled all the bananas, and left this big pile of peeled bananas in the centre of the clearing. And then they all went back to their sufferer, who sat down, right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw, back straight, head down, close their eyes, breathing in, breathing. You know what's going to happen, don't you? Excuse me, said another monkey. I've been thinking. We've been thinking now. I've been thinking. Before we eat those bananas, before we eat them, we have to put them in our mouth, first of all. We're not going to eat them. We're just going to put them in our mouth. Yeah, I was thinking the same. Yeah, wonderful. Great idea. So that's one less thing we have to think about. So they all got the banana each and put them in their mouth. They didn't eat it yet. It's not the time to eat yet. It's just getting things out of the way before you meditate. And one monkey, I'd say quite a few monkeys, put two bananas in their mouth. One put three in. They never ate them. They went back to their seats, sat down, right leg over the left leg, right paw over the left paw. Back straight, the chin in with bananas in their mouth. Close their eyes. And they ate all those bananas right there. And that was the end of their meditation. And that's what we call the monkey mind. It's not just being restless. It's let's get this out of the way. And then we can meditate later on. How many of you packed all of your belongings because you're going to go tomorrow? Another 36 hours or something. So you shouldn't pack until maybe 1 hour or half an hour or 15 minutes before you have to go. Why is it people always pack so early? Because you want to get it out of the way, first of all. We'll be thinking about it. And you notice that in your life, just going right off to the future, get this out of the way, then I don't have to do anything. But you find out when you get one thing out of the way, there's another thing to get out of the way, another thing out to get out of the way. And in the end of your life, you're finding you're getting yourself out of the way. Mm-hmm. Always off in the future somewhere. So that's one of the reasons why, when I gave that talk about monkeys and bananas and Buddhism, bananas are amazing. Just the Dhamma in those bananas. Which is why that we can find great teaching wherever you are in life. And there's one of the very famous banana stories. I never thought I could talk about bananas, but nevertheless, here we go. That how the people in, I think it was in Sri Lanka and Thailand, how they catch monkeys to take them to the zoo or whatever. It's not a very nice story, but it just shows you just how easy it is to catch people. So the farmer or the hunter, whatever it is, they go into the forest, they find a nice coconut tree and a coconut, and they drink the milk or the juice from the coconut, and they make a little hole in the coconut, just a little hole in the top. And they find a banana or something sweet to eat, call it a banana, and they put the banana in the middle of the coconut. They tie the coconut with a very strong rope to a tree, really secure. And then they leave it there. And they go back home, have a nap, have some dinner, just enjoy the evening. In the morning, they go back to that coconut. And of course, the banana is very sweet and fragrant. It'd always be a monkey who found it. But the point is, the little hole they put in the top of the coconut is only just big enough for the monkey to get its paw in. But when its paw has got a banana in it, it can't get its paw out. And so that monkey has been there all night trying to figure a way to get the banana out of the coconut. And when the hunter comes, the banana sees the hunter coming. Ah, this is dangerous. So what does the monkey need to do to escape? Let go of the banana, yeah. But can it let it go? No, that's my banana. I found it. It's mine. And so it keeps on trying to get the banana out. More and more struggle. Trying to kind of get the banana out. Just like this is the last day of the retreat. Ah, I better get some meditation quickly. Ah, what would happen? Ah. So you try even harder, trying to get the banana out this way, banana out that way. But he can't get the banana out because with the fist around the banana, it's too big to get out of the hole. And it will not let that banana go. It's mine. And that is how the hunters catch the monkeys. Do you understand? So how is it that you don't get enlightened? Well, you've got a day to go. I've got to really put some effort in today. Come on, really do it. No. You are never able to get nimittas and jhanas when you're holding it. You just can't get it out of the coconut shell. Let it go. And then you're free. So some of these stories are very beautiful stories. It's amazing to see all this. Okay, I'm going to tell this story. Sometimes I don't want to tell this story because it's a bit dangerous. But this was like a Buddhist nun. Now, you know this story, Venerable, so please, you know, make sure you don't do this, otherwise you get in big trouble. Okay? Promise? You got confidence in me. Promise anything. Okay, that was a story of the nun. 7 years she was practicing as a nun, not just 9 days. 7 years. You know the story, don't you? Okay, I promise you won't do it. No. No, you're not allowed to do this. But anyway, what this nun did, I've got to finish it now because I started it. What this nun did, 7 years she was a bhikkhuni. 7 years she'd been practicing. 7 years she never had a quiet meditation at all. Oh, it's really hard. So then she thought, what am I going to do? 7 years of practice, no peace. So she said, well, I could disrobe and go back to the home. They said, I don't want to do that. Because in those days, they had a little metaphor. They said, going back to the home is like going back to the three crooked things. It's what a bhikkhuni leaves when they leave the home and go to the monastery. The three crooked things. And the three crooked things stands for, number one, stands for the ladle which they use to cook. It always has to be a bit bent. Said, I've given up the ladle. I've given up doing cooking. I don't want to go back to that. The second crooked thing was the broom they used to sweep the house, the general housework. Said, I don't want to carry on with the broom, with the housework. And the third crooked thing was the husband. And that's what they call it, the three crooked things. And so there's a great sense of humour in those days. And anyway, I don't want to go back to the three crooked things. So what should I do? Okay, so she went into the forest. That's where monks and nuns live. Found a nice tree. Got a length of rope. Tied one end to the tree, the other end to her neck. And she was just about to jump off when she got enlightened. She let go, just in time. That is not recommended. She was lucky, or something. But why did it actually work? And it was because trying to get the banana out with your hand on it, instead of learning how to let go. When you let go, that's go to extremes again. You know, she was very, very lucky to do it just in time. But learning how to let go, not to want, not to try, that is the heart of the practice. But anyway, going back to what I told Nicholas I was going to talk about today, this is getting close to the end of the retreat, even though there's many, many more hours left. There's another, I think it's not 30, about 30 hours left of this retreat. You know, that's 1,800 minutes. You know, that's, wow, this is interesting. This is 1,800 minutes, which is 108,000 seconds. Because 108 is a very, very auspicious number. 108. Like the stupa outside there is 108% bigger than the original stupa over in Borobudur in Java. And the stories in my book, Open the Door of Your Heart, how many stories are in there? 108. In Good Pad Who Knows, how many stories? 108. 108 is a very, very auspicious number. So you have 108,000 seconds left to get enlightened. You're very lucky. Sorry, it's now 7,900. So there's plenty of time. But nevertheless, I thought a nice little topic for this morning is to talk about the beautiful. Because sometimes the people think that meditating, spiritual life, should be avoiding the beautiful. You get attached to it. It's dangerous. Don't follow the beautiful. But if you actually ever study the suttas, that is a legitimate, powerful way of meditating. The perception of the real beauty. And first of all, what the world tells you is beautiful. I'm, 69 years of age now. And every now and again, when you go on the internet to see the news, you see that somebody who was very famous when I was young, has died. And sometimes you see the photo when they were just a few years older than me, when I was young. They were just gorgeous. They were so beautiful. And I see the photographs of them now and I think, I thought that was beautiful. It's amazing just how the perceptions of beauty change. You see, I think I mentioned this to someone or here, I'm not quite sure, but when I went to India on pilgrimage many years ago, one of the many pilgrimages I've done over there, they took me to see the Taj Mahal. Have you seen the Taj Mahal? Is it beautiful? I remember looking at it and thinking, why do they call this beautiful? Why? What is beauty? And then one of the fellow retreatants, now she lives in Armidale, but she did then anyway. She's really down-to-earth girl. And she said, it's a bit over the top, isn't it? And that was a much more accurate description of that thing. But you weren't supposed to say it's over the top. You're supposed to say it's beautiful. And I realized from that and many other sort of experiences that what is beautiful is what you're taught is beautiful. And you're just agreeing with other people what beauty is. And because of that, you're not seeing beauty where it really lies. And that's one of the reasons why you see the Taj Mahal. I'd rather actually see just the sunset at Jhana Grove than the Taj Mahal. See many pictures of the Taj, but very few. You don't take. Sometimes people try to take pictures of great sunsets here, but they never really match. They never really capture the beauty. Just like that saying I said earlier on with Lao Tzu, if you think, what a beautiful sunset, you're not seeing it anymore. You take the photograph, you're not seeing it. And the you might always call it just a fraction of what's happening there when you see a photograph or even just when you see it in a book. It's only a fraction there. What real beauty is? Why is it beautiful? And one of the things with the beauty of a sunset, and one of the reasons I brought it up, is because the sky has to be imperfect to see a beautiful sunset. You need some dust, or over here, some smoke from a bushfire, or some clouds on the horizon, but not too many. You need a small amount of imperfection to be able to spread those beautiful colors across the horizon. And sometimes it's just the right amount of imperfection. And those colors spread so gorgeously. And you know as you watch it, it's not static, you can't capture it. It's disappearing as you're watching it. And your job is just to enjoy it and appreciate it. And then in a few minutes, it's gone. It's one of the reasons why the beauty of nature is something which it seems the Buddha allowed for monastics, allowed for people, because it's almost impossible to get attached to it. Because it's disappearing so fast. You just appreciate it as it fades. And that was a beauty which I remember seeing when I was young, and I see even here today. Many other things which people say are beautiful, they may look beautiful then, but they're not regarded as beautiful now. So there's something which, even though it fades, is something which really inspires you and satisfies the mind. Beautiful sights, they fade away. Or like the ocean. I remember when I used to go and teach down in Bunbury. When I taught in Bunbury, at the Bunbury prison, that because we didn't have many Anagarikas, couldn't drive down there, used to get in the train. But I needed a place to stay overnight. So somebody said the Catholics over there were very happy to let a Buddhist monk stay overnight. So I stayed in their parish house, which was really interesting because the first night, you know, they said, "Oh, come and have some dinner." They're very hospitable. I said, "No, you know, don't eat any dinner." "Oh, okay, suit yourself." And so they made a nice bed for me. And they said, "No, I don't sleep on beds." So, you know, I didn't have any dinner and slept on the floor. And the following morning, I heard the Catholic priests talking to one another. "These Buddhist monks, they're really, really holy. They don't eat and they don't sleep." The first time they've seen a Buddhist monk. So anyway, but sort of going over there, over to Bambi. Now, what was I going to talk about? It was the beauty down there. Sorry?
The ocean.
Oh, the ocean, yeah. Because one of the priests, they took me over to the prison, because I needed a lift over there as well. And as we went past, he took me past the ocean. And he said, I remember this, he said, "What do you think about the ocean, Ajahn Brahm?" And I said, "What does the ocean do to you?" And I said, "It tells me change." And his face really screwed up. He said, he wasn't really happy with my answer. He said for him it was like permanence. And I was totally opposite. So why do you say change? If you look at the big picture, as a scientist, those oceans, even the Buddha said one day they'll all dry up. And you know, they do change their heights. And there's always a movement in those oceans. It's very rare to see stillness in the oceans. And that's why that sometimes people ask me, "Don't you want to go and meditate by the ocean?" I say, "No. The oceans are very noisy." I'm thinking for myself, I'm just being honest. I'd far prefer to meditate in a cave, because caves are silent. Oceans are very noisy. But nevertheless, I must confess to you this one anecdote. I didn't have anywhere else to sit in the afternoon, so I mean, one day I arrived early at this parish house and I put my stuff down and said, "I'm just going to spend a couple of hours by the ocean." So by that time I knew Bunbury Beach, and you go south of Bunbury there on the beach, have a walk, and there's no one there. It's a very quiet ocean and quiet beach. So I found a nice place and I crossed my legs and sat meditation for a couple of hours. Yeah, good meditating, just close your eyes and disappear from the world. Very nice. The trouble was when I came out of meditation. When I came out, there's a few people around. But worse, there's someone sitting next to me on my left, someone sitting next to me on my right. And I looked to the left, and it's honestly, this was a 17-year-old girl in a bikini. a beautiful blonde, 17-year-old girl in a bikini. And I turned on my right, there's a brunette, also in a bikini, sitting next to me. Oh my goodness, what am I doing? It's an absolutely true story. I was very lucky, this was the days before mobile phones, so no one took a photograph of me. How could you explain that? I was 2 hours meditating. What had actually happened? I never realised it because I didn't look at the news enough. It was, you know, the year 12, exams. And the school was just actually opposite, you know, where I was sitting on the beach. They just finished, you know, the year 12 exams. It's all over. End of school. All of their hard work, their studies, their exams were finished. So what do? Just change into their bathers, bikinis, and just celebrate. So, you know, instead of going home, they just, nice warm afternoon, they put their bikinis and stuff on, and they went to the beach, and they saw this weird fellow in a brown robe sitting so still. And so they were very polite, these two girls, and they were just sitting next to me on either side, waiting for me to come out of meditation so they could ask me about Buddhism and meditation. But I did actually cut the conversation short for an obvious reason. And then went to go. Oh my goodness. Sometimes sitting by a beach is not really the best place to sit meditation if you're a monk for a number of reasons. Okay, Bunbury Beach stories. I left there pretty quickly. But another time when I was meditating by that beach, that I was meditating quite peacefully. I'd only just started meditation. And then I heard something go past my ear. Whoosh. And I hear the sound of something hitting the beach just past me. And I heard something else go past me. And I thought, this is really weird. And then I heard the sound of somebody shouting out, "Get off our beach, Rajneeshi!" That was the time of, you know, the Osho Rajneesh. And many, many people just really were against what he was up to. And because I was wearing my robes, they thought I was a follower of the Bhagawan. Then another stone came past my ear. And I realized that if I keep staying there, sooner or later, you know, one of those stones will hit me. So I thought, I better do something. So I got up from my meditation seat. And then they all started shouting at me. There's about 8 or 9 kids. About 13, 14-year-olds, "Get off our beach." So I turned around and started walking towards them. That was wonderful. They never expected that. And as I walked towards them, they all ran away except one. One started to run away, but he came back in as I was walking towards him. When I came towards him, I could have a conversation with him. He said, "Oh, I'm not a Rajneeshi, but even if I was, it's not a good thing to throw rocks at them. Don't know why you don't like anybody, you know, maybe for good reason. But throwing rocks at someone is a good reason for people not to like you." He said, "Well, who are you then?" I said, "I'm a Buddhist monk." "Oh, Buddhist, I'm sorry." And they all came back and we had a nice conversation about Buddhism and meditation. And I thought, that's a wonderful way when you don't have fear, you can actually walk towards the stones and it always works out so well for you. So always remember that. And to this day, if there's anything you're afraid of, don't walk away from it. Walk towards it. See what happens. Then you have the power. Then you are the one in charge rather than the one which is fleeing. And even I say this because I was a member of the Psychic Research Society for so many years, that if ever you do see a real ghost, I mean a real one, not these sort of the ghosts I was talking about last night, if you see a real ghost, just don't run away. Just turn around and walk towards them. You know, ghosts, there's so many questions you'd like to ask about ghosts. Like, what, number one, why? What do you do during the daytime? You only come out at night. Where do you go during the day? And like, you know, ghosts are beings like anybody else. You know, do ghosts fall in love? A male ghost and a female ghost? And decide to have little baby ghosts? Do you get bored being a ghost? If you met a real ghost and you really wanted to make a name for yourself, just interview the ghost. And you can publish that in the New Yorker magazine or wherever, and you'll make a lot of money. The first in-depth interview of a ghost. I don't know, people want to interview all sorts of people. Sometimes they want to interview me. But, you know, it's pretty boring as a monk. But if you're a real ghost, imagine doing that interview. That would be fascinating. So what I'm doing here, you're trying to challenge stereotypes, challenge your usual behavior, do it a little bit different. And then you find you're in charge, you're free, you're not a victim of things anymore. But anyway, going back to the beautiful sunsets, what is beautiful in your life? Sometimes, oh, this has just came up, because I used to be really into poetry when I was a student. I used to carry around a book of poetry by John Keats. And in his book, his poem, a long poem, Endymion, it starts off with this wonderful line, "A thing of beauty is a joy forever. A thing of beauty is a joy forever." To me, that was a definition of what beauty is. Not so transient beauty, just like a beautiful person or a beautiful meadow or something. Something which is longer lasting than that. So what is joyful for you? Joy forever. When you're middle-aged, when you're old, when you're sick. What can be a joy when you're sick and in pain and even dying? If you understand what's a joy then, you understand what beauty truly is. And that's one of the reasons why the beauty is our emotional response to whatever's happening. And that type of beauty is something which, with a little bit of training and a little bit of rebelliousness, not just thinking, oh, it's sickness. How can you enjoy sickness? How can that be beautiful? It's painful. And then you go back to the second toilet cubicle in the male toilets. And Ajahn Brahm's experience, seeing his feces. And that, sometimes I tell jokes, but that was actually real. That really did look beautiful. And it was challenging me. What is beauty? How can you see beauty in something which the whole world would say needs to be flushed away? So that taught me a lot. You can see beauty anywhere. It becomes a joy forever. And hopefully when any one of you comes to your interviews, when I look at you now, see the beauty in you. The beautiful woman sitting over there, Sudama. How old are you now, Sudama? Beautiful. Is that beautiful? How can you see beauty in a 73-year-old woman? It's not something you can own and capture. It's something you can respect and see and be inspired by. Something which creates a joy forever in you. The goodness, the kindness, the honesty, the fearlessness. That is what is beauty. And hopefully, when you see all the people you've shared your cottage with on this weekend, on this meditation retreat, and all the people you've met, you know, you may look, they've got injured scars, they may have just hair falling out, they may not be just like a supermodel in the conventional terms, but there's still a huge amount of beauty in them. I know sometimes I still can't, well, I suppose I should be able to figure this out. When I was young, no one wanted to take a photograph of me. But now I'm old and fat. So
so many people want to take photographs of me. Take a photograph of the Ajahn Brahm. And the worst culprits of them all are the Indonesians. Where are they? Yeah, Indonesian over there. Honestly, because whenever I go to Indonesia, they always want to take photographs. And the problem is, it's not just one photograph. It's a photograph just myself, and then myself with that person with one of their friends and their family. And all the combinations are huge. And what happened? I was just transiting in Singapore Airport from Perth I think it was going over to Thailand or somewhere, could have been to Hong Kong or something. And as you're walking, you know, from one gate to another gate to catch your flight, I met all these Indonesians. And they said, we're just coming back from pilgrimage to India. It's Ajahn Brahm. Can we take a photograph of you? And very stupidly, I said yes. And there's about 30 or 40 of them there.
Oh, no.
Yeah, exactly. So I had 30 individual snaps. And then another 30 with their partner, and then their kids, and this person. It went on for so long. And I said, I've got to go to the terminal. I said, you make it in time. It's the only time, actually, in my life, and I've travelled a lot, when they're calling out my name. Brahma Wangso, please come now, the flight is ready to go. Why do they want to do this? Why do you want to take a photograph of me? I'm not like Brad Pitt. Is he the sort of the hot guy now? Who's the hot guy now? And don't say Ajahn Brahm, otherwise you'll get in big trouble. Anyway, so sometimes. So I can't understand why people want to do this, but there's something beautiful. Maybe in the kindness, the smile, the gentleness, the inspiration. What is it which makes it a possible joy forever you want to photograph it? That is beauty. And so after a while, you see the beauty in goodness, in kindness, in kind people. It's just a beautiful hall here. There's hardly any embellishments. There's no paintings. There's a Buddha in there. But other than that, it's pretty functional, this place. But sometimes you look at it and it's beautiful. Why? Why is this place beautiful? Simplicity. It's welcoming you. There's a few signs. Don't put your chair against the walls or something. But there's hardly any signs telling you what to do. So you feel accepted and safe. In a world where you're often judged and criticized, you don't get that here. Isn't that a joy forever? Just to be, instead of having to prove yourself to somebody. You know that we don't give certificates out after this retreat. You know, sometimes people are asking, can you do this? And they can't give some certificates because then it makes it easier to get a direct gift recipient tax exemption from any donations. Because it's supposed to be a school building fund. And say, what school are you in? What, do you get a degree? Do you get a certificate? So if you give a certificate, it'd be much easier for us actually to get that thing from the government. There's something really terribly against giving certificates out. You know, even just the fact that you've been here for 9 days, just being here. Have you really been here? Have you been off in fantasy land and dream world and checking your mobile phones? Have you really been here? Doesn't matter. You've been here as much as you possibly can. Well done. But we don't give certificates out. So you don't have to worry, are you going to get graded at the end of this retreat? Grade A, B, C, D, E, or F? Because people get worried if their kids get all these grades at school. And sometimes the kid comes up to me and says, can you tell my mummy it's not the end of the world, I got grade F? So you got grade F at school? I said, yeah, I got grade F. Did anyone tell you what F means? F means fantastic. E means excellent. D means delightful. A means arrogant.
You turn it around to try and stop all this thinking that achievement is the goal of life. Instead, we can find beauty in just being here. But anyway, one of those stories. There was a retreat centre. I don't know why poor Sri Lanka's getting hammered today, but this was in Sri Lanka. There's a lovely, lovely, lovely meditation teachings, and many of my monks are over in Sri Lanka right now. But anyway, in Sri Lanka, there was a meditation centre. And it was getting quite well known. And they give out certificates afterwards, you know, it's much longer than a 9-day, I think it's about a month. They do teachings and make sure you understand what's going on, check your meditation. And they give certificates afterwards, if you deserve one. So anyway, there was this old auntie from the countryside in Sri Lanka, and she was visiting her friends and her family in Colombo, the capital city. And the friends and relations in Colombo said, what can we get for our old auntie, grandma? She's come all this way to see us. What would she really like? And she was one of these simple living people who didn't want much in the world. So they heard about this retreat centre, said, would you like to go on this retreat centre? We can sponsor you for 1 month. She said, yeah, okay. So they collected the money to sponsor the grandma to go to this retreat centre for 1 month. And she was a very good meditator. She went to the temple all the time in her village and had pretty good meditation. Been listening to all these monks for such a long time, she had a very good understanding of Buddhism. So when they gave her these examinations, both oral and written, she did really well. And so at the end of the retreat, you know, in the last ceremony with all the retreatants, they called her up and said, Grandma, said, Auntie, you've done really, really, really well. You know, we've talked about this, lay people teaching this retreat. We've talked about your meditation, your understanding of Dhamma. We've all come to the unanimous conclusion that you are a stream winner. And they gave her this lovely certificate signed by all the leaders of the retreat that Grandma had actually become a stream winner. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And they handed it to her. She got very angry. She's very upset. Auntie, why are you upset? It's a soul one. That's a Sri Lankan word for stream. And it's a wonderful achievement. It's amazing. Why are you so upset? And she looked at them like only an old auntie can look at you. It really worries you. And they said, you don't remember me, do you? They looked at her, no, we don't remember you. I said, I came here about 3 years ago. When I came on that retreat, you gave me a non-returner certificate. You've demoted me. And that actually happened, apparently. And that went around Colombo. And that retreat centre soon closed down. So you don't give certificates out. It's not about attainments. It's about disappearings. Now imagine this, that there's less of you. There's less ego, there's less sense of, you know, me owning things. Less sense of responsibility to your possessions. And more just the responsibility to sharing and being with others. Being by yourself happy. Not needing anything. What do you need to possess? Plenty for everybody. Yeah. Who owns Jhana Grove? Okay, don't say the BSWA. That's just only legally. But who actually owns Jhana Grove? Of course, we do. The flies own it. The kangaroos. The ghosts. Anyone is welcome. Isn't it wonderful when we share and leave it open? There's far less sense of worry about the place. So, same with, as you meditate more and more,
you own less and less and less. You try and give away more and more and more. You become more of a loser. What a wonderful term that is. Become a loser. It goes totally against the way of the world. You want to be a winner. You want to make it. And my answer is, make what? You make it. Make what? I don't really know. What are you trying to achieve in life? Success? Being the front page of the newspapers? Is that really what you want in life? All those politicians, which I got to know, when they leave politics, then they feel so much free, they feel alive again. Going into politics means like going into jail. And they're tortured by the press all the time. They just pick their nose once, and that's the thing which goes on the front page of the newspapers. Ajahn Brahm picked his nose in public. Actually, it's quite nice. But don't do it in public. Okay, so. Poor Ajahn Chah, when he was getting old, just before he had a stroke, he was doing one of these big ceremonies, and he was outrageous, that Ajahn Chah. He wanted to go to the toilet, but it was raining outside, so he just got a bowl. He went in the corner in front of everybody. Very practical, what's wrong with that? It's a big natural. We didn't own his reputation. That's another thing which sometimes we own our reputation, who we think we are. And when you own your reputation, who you think you are, and you think that's beautiful, having a good reputation. I am Ajahn Brahm. I am the great meditator. I am the great joker. If you worry about who you are, then when people don't laugh at one of your jokes, you feel terrible. But instead of doing that, just be a loser. So it doesn't matter if you like the joke, don't like the joke. The point is, I always like my jokes. That's the most important. Anyway. Oh, yeah. Okay, so anyway, beauty. Then you look at your meditation. You know, whatever's beautiful, you can watch without effort. If there is like a beautiful sunset, it just draws you. You stop and spend a long time there. The beautiful sky at night, you just watch it. You see a nice flower, just look at it. You can't take your eyes off it. It is a joy, and it is the secret of sustained attention. Not concentration through force, but seeing the beauty in just being in this moment. What a beautiful place to stay. Not Jhana Grove, the present moment, wherever that present moment happens to be. You develop the ability, inclination, to see beauty in things. See beauty in the lovely bamboo floor. See beauty in the unexpected, like the green tape on that floor. See beauty in the pimples on a person's face. Just how well separated they are and how they form this amazing undefined pattern on their face. See beauty in the unexpected places. And then you can see beauty in your own mind. Imperfect, still lots of defilements, still you think lots of way to go. You look upon it, it's beautiful. That was the meaning of the trees in the forest. To see all those bent and crooked trees and see how beautiful they are. Oh, that story of the two bad bricks in the wall. Later on telling that story, it's a wonderful place to have this anecdote from. At the Cancer Association in Cottesloe, And this guy came up, he said, I'm a builder. It's many years ago now, he had some cancers. And he said, I want to tell you that all bricklayers make mistakes. So, you know, you're trying to be a perfect bricklayer. There's no such thing as a perfect bricklayer in the sense of one never makes crooked bricks. But he said, because I've been in the industry a long time, he said, whenever, you know, one of my bricklayers makes a mistake like that, and he said, please don't tell anybody, but I never agreed on it, so I've told lots of people. Whenever we make a mistake like that, we always tell our clients. It's a feature. It's unique. There's no other houses in Perth like this. And we charge them a few thousand extra dollars. And I thought that was a brilliant end to that story. The mistakes, what makes beauty? What creates it? What allows you to look at that, whatever it is, and see the beauty in it. The trouble with the Taj Mahal, it's just too perfect. That's why it's not beautiful. It's almost not human. All you over here are so imperfect. That's why you're beautiful. Your mind. Is your mind perfect yet? Is it all crooked and bent and twisted? Yeah. Therefore, you can look upon it as a thing of beauty and a joy forever. It changes your perceptions. Sometimes we think of all our faults, our restless mind, stupid thoughts, inability to be still, worrying about things you don't need to worry about, blah, blah, blah. How about looking upon that as beautiful? Giving it some respect. Your crazy mind is gorgeous. Then what do you think will happen next? You'll stay with your crazy mind because it's gorgeous. It's easy to look at and it brings you happiness and joy. It means you focus. It means you get pretty still. It means you get very peaceful. It means you get limitless. It means you get jhana. It means you get enlightened. There's only 108,000 seconds left and that's a few. So if you want to get enlightened, how about changing your perception of the beautiful? And seeing the beautiful inside yourself right now. In this moment. It brings you joy. It brings you energy. It brings you inspiration. I don't want inspiration. I don't mean what somebody wrote on the board this morning. Inspiration leads to desperation, leads to expiration. The three spirations. But it actually does give you beautiful energy when you see it in the right places. And it makes it so easy to meditate, so easy to be happy. The thing of beauty is a joy forever. Any beautiful teachings you've heard here, you remember them because they were beautiful. And they give you a joy for so many years. That's why when you understand what beauty is, what real beauty is, you realize that this is not Jhana Grove Retreat Center you've been in. This is Jhana Grove's beauty spa. Ajahn Brahm's salon. So that's a talk for today. I hope you found it beautiful. Sadhu. 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 Very good. Okay.